Folks, I'm Alfred Addisk, and our guest is James Corbett here on the Financial Survival. James, are you there?
I certainly am. Can you hear me?
Sure can. James is the author and mastermind behind the Corbett Report. He has lots of intelligent articles, videos, give you some insight into what's happening around the world. One of his articles right now is Fukushima's four-year anniversary. It's not an article per se. It's a video, matter of fact. I see it posted on his blog. I'm looking at it right now or on his website. Again, the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T report. And it's almost hard to believe that it's 4 years since the reactors at Fukushima blew up, disintegrated, whatever word you want to place on it. Is that problem being resolved? Is it going to be with us forever? What's happening there, James?
Resolved is not the word that I would use. And more or less prettied up so it doesn't look as bad to the international community might be a more apt description. But for people who don't know, the fundamental underlying problem of the fact that these reactor cores have melted down and melted through to some extent primary containment, and who knows exactly where and how they're lying. We certainly don't have any clear idea of that because the technology to get near enough to the reactors to actually detect that does not yet exist. So the underlying problem at Fukushima certainly hasn't gone away. And compounding on that are all of the secondary problems of radioactive water leaking through and around and out of the plant in various ways. And then, of course, the original problem from the immediate aftermath of all the fallout, which contaminated the area, obviously, around Fukushima and for some distance around, is being prettied up, as I say, in kind of a decontamination theater that so far the Japanese government has spent $13.5 billion on decontamination efforts and are slated to spend at least another $3.5 billion, basically going house to house, door to door in the surrounding areas and some of the surrounding villages, washing everything down by hand, scraping off the top layer of soil, churning up undersoil, putting down new soil, and just doing this in a painstaking, ridiculously meticulous effort from, as I say, door to door, that isn't really fundamentally, I think, going to change the underlying situation, as I say, of the melted down reactor cores. And even in terms of decontamination, it's questionable how much this is actually improving the surrounding area at all. So it is comfortable, I guess, to see so much effort and work going into it, and it makes people psychologically comforted, but I don't think it's actually doing a lot in terms of addressing the underlying problem.
What do you think about the Japanese who are working at creating this theater, cleaning the problem, or at least the surface manifestations of the problem? How are these workers adjusting to their role? Are they resigned, optimistic, pessimistic? Are they going to die an early death? What's going to happen here?
Well, in that video that you cite, the Fukushima four-year anniversary, we talk about a article that's from the LA Times talking about the Fukushima cleanup, and they have some interesting interviews with some of the workers who are involved in this project and some of the people who have been affected by it. And I don't think a lot of people are really excited or optimistic about what's happening. I think resigned might be the best way to describe it. I think the only people who might see anything of value out of this are the people who are profiting from those tens of billions of dollars that are being shelled out on this work. But unfortunately, that being the Japanese construction and reconstruction industry, of course, it's mostly dominated by the Japanese mafia and retired policemen who may or may not be kind of the same thing at the end of the day. So it's just unfortunately more of the kind of crony work, make work that's going on right now. And there have been repeated documented violations of basic labor laws here, including hiring homeless people to work at, you know, ridiculously low wages to do extremely dangerous tasks without the proper equipment and things of that nature that continue to go on. They continue to get busted on a regular basis. So again, I think this is obviously making a lot of money for some well-connected people, but it's not doing a lot to, it's certainly not doing anything to help the lives of the 79,000 people who still can't even return to their homes because they've been evacuated from the evacuation zone.
I have to assume that you saw the movie Dr. Strangelove.
I certainly have, yes.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember there was a scene where the Russian ambassador was down in the war room with the United States president, the rest of the, they triggered a device that was going to, they were in the process of triggering a device that would destroy the whole world, and he's down there in the war room and he's taking secret pictures. Right. It's not going to make any difference. You understand? The world is going to heck in a handbasket. Do you see a similarity between Dr. Strangelove and the theater that's taking place in Fukushima right now?
I hadn't really considered it that way, but yes, I mean, that's a pretty good example of the mindset of some people, certainly, just, who are involved in this.
You're talking about people just making money off of something that may be just extraordinarily horrific. There are people in the United States that are concerned that the radiation is reaching the United States and it may cause some problems, measurable problems over here. If it's true that radiation is crossing the Pacific Ocean to reach the United States, how much radiation is moving from Fukushima, which, as I understand it, is in northern Japan, down to your location, which I understand, I'm not sure, but I believe you are kind of on southeastern Japan. Fukushima's north. Excuse me, Fukushima, northeastern Japan, you're southwestern Japan, is that true?
That's right. So I'm about 400 miles southwest of the Fukushima site. And so as people probably know, the prevailing winds blew a lot of the initial radioactive fallout into the Pacific Ocean. And of course, a lot of it continues to spill out, as I say, through the water leaks that are flowing through the plant down into the ocean. So a lot of the fallout has gone that direction, more so than it went in the westerly direction. And it's interesting. I mean, there is no U.S. government agency at this point that is tracking the radiation in the Pacific Ocean specifically. There are initiatives, for example, the crowdfunded initiative that's being organized by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute that is doing sampling and measuring right now, relying on basically crowdfunded resources in order to do this work. They're at ourradioactiveocean.org. And so far, they've found that there are, I mean, the radiation is crossing the Pacific and it is reaching the western shores of the United States. The question is, to what extent? In what, is it
significant?
Yeah, is it really significant? Exactly.
And do we have any idea on that?
At this point, the results that I have seen do not indicate that this is something that is at this point able to actually significantly affect marine life, for example, on the west coast of the United States specifically. But again, the question is how much is coming and in what sort of layers is it going to arrive? And then how does knock-on effects of certain things that can affect certain aspects of what's going on in the marine world, how does that go on up the food chain and then ultimately end up in humans? And again, I mean, it should be disturbing for no other fact alone than the fact that there is no government agency that is currently actually tasked with trying to identify or in any way describe this radiation or how it may be affecting the West Coast.
All by itself, that's a very dangerous sign. If the government's not even monitoring the problem, you can sit back and they are paying people to count how many people with brown shoes come across borders. All right, they monitor everything, but they're not monitoring this. You have to suspect it's because they don't want to report the problem because it is significant, and they don't want to report it to the American people.
We would not be, we would be suckers to expect otherwise, I think, given the history of the United States or organizations that are devoted to protecting the people. I think we would have to be suspicious of the fact that they are not actively engaged in this.
Let's move to Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu has been reelected as Prime Minister of Israel. I don't know, is he Prime Minister or President?
Prime Minister.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But he's not getting along with Barack Obama. The Obama administration, today they announced, or after the election, the Israeli election, they congratulated Israel on having another election, but they offered no congratulations to Benjamin Netanyahu, who won the election. It's pretty apparent that there is a great deal of antagonism between Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Obama. What's that mean for the future? How serious is that problem? Is that just a couple of people who just can't stand each other? All right, but it's not politically significant. Is this just a personal animosity? Or does this point to Israel being increasingly isolated in the Middle East?
If there are any actual political or economic ramifications of this rift that seems to be going on right now between Netanyahu and Obama, I haven't seen them. And so I haven't seen anything that's actually affected policy in the region or affected the aid that America is giving to Israel or anything significant in that way. We've seen some of the theatrics of this, like Netanyahu's speech to Congress and bypassing the White House with regards to that diplomacy and things of that nature, which do indicate that type of tension. But at the end of the day, again, if it doesn't actually translate into any significant divergence of U.S. foreign policy, then the question is, does it really matter? And given that Netanyahu has just won a fresh mandate and Obama is a lame duck president in the twilight of his presidency, again, does the relation between Netanyahu and Obama even really matter for much more than the next year? And again, I think it doesn't seem like it's a significant, I don't see any changes, significant fundamental changes coming in the U.S.-Israeli partnership anytime in the near future.
Do you think that the appearance of animosity, antagonism, friction between the two men, do you think that will inspire ISIS, for example, to exert more pressure on Israel? If we've only got a year to go when Obama's there, we can expect the next president would be more supportive of Israel. Does that mean now's the time to strike?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because the question poses that ISIS is in fact opposed to Israel, and yet so far in this conflict, we have not seen ISIS attacking Israeli positions or interests at all in the conflict that's taken place so far. And the interesting thing is that we now have confirmed the fact that ISIS fighters are being cared for in Israeli hospitals. So there is an interesting connection going on there that seems to suggest the exact opposite of the fact that ISIS and Israel's interests are opposed. And I think this goes back to admitted Israeli foreign policy doctrine that goes back at least as far as the 1980s, the doctrine is to split up states like Syria that could pose any sort of regional opposition to Israel and its foreign policy goals. And they talked explicitly about this in various foreign policy papers from the 1980s forwards about the plan to break up countries like Syria, like Iraq, into warring factions that would make them basically irrelevant as potential opposition to Israel. And along comes something like ISIS, funded 100% openly and without any question at this point by the United States and its allies, trained at secret bases, attended by U.S. armed forces in Jordan, all of these various connections, and it seems to be fulfilling exactly that Israeli foreign policy goal of breaking up Syria and Iraq. So I really don't think that this will embolden ISIS to do anything whatsoever towards Israel or its interests. But, you know, I stand to be corrected, but I haven't seen anything of the sort at this point.
It's really an extraordinary world we live in. It's almost, you wonder, where can you see things and just look at them and you can see them for face value and know what they are? Within the political world, that's not very common. The description you're providing for ISIS being associated with Israel, not wanting to attack Israel, just astonishing. I mean, it's just astonishing. And what have we got then? Just a bunch of mercenaries? ISIS is really just a bunch of mercenaries? Is that all we're dealing with?
I think it's more complicated than that, because obviously there are fighters who are motivated by genuine religious convictions and genuinely are fighting for the establishment of an Islamic caliphate, and that is what they tend to be doing. But the question of the logistics of the funding, of the training, of the operation of something as truly massive as ISIS has become, that sort of development can't take place without the explicit, at the very least, protection or sort of laying back of the various forces in the region, which generally are in control of such things. And I mean, just one example of that is, of course, the big ISIS convoy that swept through Iraq last summer, which could not have taken place in any world in which the United States or any of the other powers that are already in the region militarily hadn't allowed that type of progression to take place. So I understand the incredulity at the sort of general thesis here that, well, how can this be? How could these rabid Islamic fighters be working in conjunction with Israel, working in conjunction with the West? It doesn't seem to make sense. But that is because we have been fed a version of reality that does not correspond to reality. Almost everything that takes place on the geopolitical stage at this point is a deception of one form or another. And from the perspective of people who are trying to manipulate various pieces of the global chessboard, it makes perfect sense that you do want to keep the public in a state of confusion and misinformed, and in a misinformed state, because it is much easier to accomplish various goals if that is the case, so that you can, for example, get the United States population on board with bombing Syria, something that even a year and a half, 2 years ago, was pretty much unthinkable. We had the Hands Off Syria campaign, people marching in the streets in New York and other places saying, do not attack Syria, you guys are just trying to start something with this chemical weapons talk with Syria and Assad. You just change that script a little bit, and it's about this ISIS group, which has been, again, admittedly funded and trained by the U.S. and its allies, and suddenly most people on the street are for it, and just start talking about, well, just turn it into a glass parking lot. So, again, people can be manipulated an entire...
We've got to take a break here, James, for some commercial announcements. So when we come back, we'll talk a little more about misinformation propaganda. I'm Alfred Addis, here on Financial Survival with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. Hi, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival. My guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. We're talking about most of the information, the idea that much of the information, probably most of what we receive concerning geopolitics is deceptive. And there is no end to the misinformation. Where do we find the truth? How likely are we to find it? And are the American people, for example, or the Japanese people, or any people, how many people are content with the lies? Not really looking for the truth. What percentage of the populations do you think might fall into that classification?
I would hesitate to put a number on it, but I think it's probably much more than we would like to think. Everyone, of course, likes to believe themselves to be a bastion of reason and clear-headedness and, oh, I don't get fooled by scams. But people are exceptionally prone to being fooled, especially when they kind of want to be fooled. And this is a phenomenon that shouldn't be surprising to Financial Survival listeners thinking about this in economic terms, where we know that there is so much economic mis and disinformation that's floated around the talking head media about what's going on economically speaking, that when you actually look at what's happening and you see the discrepancy, you wonder, how can anyone even fall for this? In some ways, it's the just the sheer size and magnitude and scale and pervasiveness of the lies that make them so effective. But the other side of that is that people kind of want to be fooled by these lies because they're comforting and they provide a narrative by which most people can, or for a very long time, people have been able to live their entire lives in this cocoon, believing that the world is a certain way and it works out well enough for them, and they can grow old and die on their pensions, and there you go. And so they've had a well and fulfilling life, and that's worked out well for a generation or two, at any rate, of Americans and others in the Western world. And so the delusions are comforting, and it's not hard to understand why that is. It's also not hard to understand how simple some of the deceptions can be. In fact, I was reading a pretty fascinating article today from BBC Future, of all places, talking about how pickpockets trick your mind, talking about the various ways that pickpockets can basically take your money right from under your nose. And even if you're kind of looking at it, even if you know what's happening, you can be distracted in just the simplest ways from what's actually happening. And I think if we take those types of simple psychological phenomenon that we can relate to on an individual level and just apply them on the societal level, how much more effective can that be? And how much can the fate of entire nations and peoples and economies and the world itself be directed by that type of manipulation and sleight of hand? And I think we're going to, unfortunately, have an answer of that one way or another in this century, as we are shaped up towards some type of giant conflict. Again, we've seen the signposts along the way towards a very similar situation developing right now as what was developing at the turn of the beginning of the 20th century, where we saw Germany as the rising power threat, and the U.S. as on the verge of its superpower status, and the British Empire starting to wane. We're here now with the U.S. superpower starting to show signs of cracks in its facade, and the Chinese dragon rising, and very, very worryingly similar situation. So, unfortunately, again, the public perishes for lack of knowledge, and that is driving us to this point where we are being driven into a type of conflict that may be decisive in terms of the future of the history of the human race. And I don't say that lightly. I think we are in world historical times, and they're only getting more world historical from here.
I agree with you. You know, Assad, we've got the internet. We have extraordinary capacity for communication. You and I are evidence of that. You know, the technology, we got a little box, a little computer, costs less than $1,000, that's enabling me to talk to someone in Japan and broadcast over the radio system. It's the technology for communicating news and communicating truth is unparalleled. Never seen anything like it before, but at the same time, we've got the same technology that can be used to communicate lies. Which purpose? Do you see that either purpose is predominant and likely to continue to be gain power, or which one is waxing, waning? Do you see a change there, a difference?
I do. I've talked about this in a bunch of my work in the past, because it's something that obviously I deal with directly in my own personal experience. Here I am, as you say, in Japan, sitting here in my apartment, broadcasting to the world and speaking to tens or hundreds of thousands of people on a weekly basis. It's mind-boggling. It's something that I can scarcely even understand how this has happened, let alone even imagine it happening as little as a decade ago. This was pretty much unthinkable, and yet here I am doing this. So we are going through that type of transition, which I think it is potentially so incredibly wonderful for the potential that it brings of people really being able to instantaneously connect peer-to-peer, as it were, directly with each other through decentralized networks, where we don't have to have these overarching global institutions to direct everything that humans are doing in the ways that an argument could be made for those types of big centralized governments in the past, because, well, you know, how else are you going to direct a nation of 300 million people or whatever the case may be? But we are now at the point where we can truly fundamentally rethink the way that humans relate to each other and the types of organizations and things that are possible. Of course, as you say, this is the very same technology, is a double-edged sword, and can be used for the type of oppression and tyranny that was once the realm of the science fiction fantasists and people's nightmares of, you know, a 1984 Brave New World society. So we are at that extremely interesting cusp, and so much of it is what we make of it. And this comes back to that question you asked earlier, which I thought was an interesting question. How do we find the truth? Not where do we find the truth? Because I don't think there is any one source of information that people can rely on. I think it really is in this mesh, this network, this vast decentralized database of the sum total of human knowledge that we now have an incredible amount of information at our fingertips to access. But how do you sort through that, and how do you find the truth from that? And again, I don't think there is any one particular node on that network that is the truth, and that is the place you should go. Even the Corbett Report, even Financial Survival, I don't think that any one source is going to be the place where people have to go to understand what's happening. It has to be a process that we have to come to of finding ways to sort through good information and bad information, and compare information and compare notes with each other in this peer-to-peer fashion that we're doing online. And through that, we can come to a better understanding of the world than we ever will, I think, relying on any one source, or on any, of course, establishment source that's been feeding us lies for decades and generations. Unfortunately, that means it is work. I mean, people do have to put in work in order to get the value out of this information and what's potentially there. But I don't know. For myself, personally, I couldn't imagine living with myself if I wasn't able to or willing to put in the work to try to come to a better understanding of the world that I'm living in. If for no other reason, then of course, I do have a son that I truly do care about this world and the state that it's left in after myself, for my son and his progeny and going forward from there. And I think anyone out there who has a similar concern about where the world is going has to be willing to put in at least a little bit of effort to try to come to some better understanding of the truth. So I see it as a process, an ongoing process of not just finding information, but comparing information, putting it into the theoretical frameworks and seeing whether or not that compares to reality, making predictions and testing them against reality and things of that nature to try to see if we're on the right track. And it's about constantly refining our methods and our understanding of truth itself, not simply arriving at the truth.
I think it's a regular process. You've got to be dedicated to search for it on an almost minute-by-minute basis, and not just say, okay, I'm going to go look for the truth today, and then the rest of the month, I'm going to watch TV. You've got to actually be looking for the truth full-time. It's a full-time, as I'm sure you understand, this is a full-time occupation, and it's part of the reason why most people don't get into it. Because it's not just a question of looking for truth, it's a question of comparing, here's what I thought, and here's what the facts indicate. And it's a question of admitting, oh, I made a mistake. I thought I had the truth. Turns out I made a mistake. You have to try to sharpen your own judgment in the process of compare, observe, on a regular basis. Eventually, you might get pretty shrewd. But the way the world is, I wonder if the truth is easily accessible right now. What is, you say, what are fundamental truths? If you don't go into the spiritual realm, what are the fundamental truths right now? We've got 7 billion people who need to be fed. That's one truth, one fundamental truth. What are we going to do about that?
Well, that's a very important point, because there are those types of basic fundamental biological truths that have always held for the human species and presumably always will, or at least until we invent some sort of technological hack around such things. But at any rate, for the time being, yes, there are 7 billion mouths to feed and 7 billion people to have some sort of roof over their head or some sort of protection from the elements, and those basic types of necessities that continue to be there. And when we think of it in those terms, I mean, it's interesting to think of the period right after the end of the Second World War, where the United States was the unquestionable superpower of the world. In fact, the strongest superpower in the history of the world, and was beginning to economically boom in a way that has seldom been paralleled in history. So much seemed at the fingertips of the average American, and there was this unbounded optimism about the future. And of course, visions of the future would be, well, in the future, you'll be able to work 20 hours a week because everything will be mechanized, and you'll have so much time to spend with your family and friends, and it'll all be great. Somehow that didn't pan out, even though we have progressed, quote unquote, so much from that point in terms of the productivity that various technologies have allowed, we still are, in fact, working more than ever for the most part. And usually at this point, we used to have one parent working and one parent at home taking care of children. Now the standard, the norm, is for to have two parents working and students or children in government indoctrination camps. What is happening? Why are we degressing? Why are we going backwards, seemingly, and away from the goal?
With population density, the technology is moving at one rate; the population is increasing at another. I'm not sure that they're not moving in lockstep and in parallel. And I think we wind up with more people. We're generating mouths faster than we can, generate the food to freedom for whatever reason.
I disagree with that assessment.
That there's a valid technological reason why we can't feed the people.
I disagree. I think we can feed the people. I think that the food exists. It's the question of how is that distributed. And I'm not for redistribution in some sort of socialist sense, but I think that the question of how and why people are working harder than ever and barely managing to scrape by is the question of the fundamental engineering of the economy itself through, I think, the monetary system, which is controlled sort of behind the scenes, sort of that sleight of hand that we're not supposed to look at when they're picking our pocket, as it were. I think that's the fundamental mechanism that has been engineered into, baked into the cake that basically has brought us to this point. And unless and until we really understand that mechanism by which our pockets are being picked by the Fed and by institutions like that, we'll never be able to escape the 9-to-5 grind or 7-to-8 grind or whatever it is these days in order to actually
16-hour-day grind before we're done with this.
Exactly. Exactly right. It will continue to increase because they can't allow us the leisure to use this technology for information purposes. That's our power. That's what they're really afraid of, and that's what we have to fight tooth and nail to protect, as the FCC, for example, comes along and tries to regulate the internet and other ways they're going to try to clamp down on what's happening right now. So again, these are world historical times. We are history's actors. We have to take this into our own hands and start using this technology to the absolute maximum that it's possible.
That's the one disability that might be associated with the internet. Politics requires bodies out on the street. I'm not sure that the internet does that. Internet delivers a lot of people who understand, they have an opinion, they're concerned, they're passionate, but they stay in their little rooms and they don't get out on the street to bump, shoulders, elbows, whatever, with the rest of the great unwashed, get their torches and their pitchforks and tell government, you better straighten up or we're coming for you.
100% agreed. We need real communities once again. We need to rediscover community.
I agree with you.
Yes.
I agree. And that's something that's being lost with the internet. A lot of information, but not much community. James, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being on the program. Look forward to talking to you again next week. We'll remind people to visit the Corbett Report, Corbett Report.com. And I'm Alfred Addisk. This is Financial Survival. Be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.
I work all night. I work all day.